UK Wine Show Show number 165. Sotheby's Wine with Stephen Mould. G'day, it's the 17th of July 2009 and this is the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and we have another fantastic show for you this week. We're talking with Stephen Mould, Senior Director of Sotheby's Wine Department. Stephen's been working for Sotheby's most of his life, and we find out about the history and the characters of Sotheby's. In the spotlight, we're looking at reduction and oxidation in winemaking. And this week we have a mystery grape variety for you guys to work out. This time it's a white grape developed by the French as a hybrid, which produces wines with fruity floral characters. Its parents are Uni Blanc, which is Trebbiano for the rest of you guys, and the other parent is a hybrid, Civil Blanc. I'm going to give you more clues after the news, which is coming up with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. UK wine drinkers are less concerned with the specific region their wine comes from and more interested in the country of origin and whether the wine's on promotion or not. That's according to the latest survey by the Wine and Spirit Trade Association, which showed 48% of respondents said region's important against 59% who wanted to know which country before making their buying decision. The survey also showed that promotions are more important than ever, with 77% of respondents saying discounts like £3 for £10 or money off were very important compared to 61% 3 years ago. Chardonnay is still the nation's favourite white wine, but Pinot Grigio has overtaken Sauvignon Blanc as the UK's second most popular white grape variety. The survey was carried out amongst just over 3,000 regular UK wine drinkers in March and April of 2009.
Many people in the wine trade congratulate the supermarkets for making wine more accessible to the UK drinker. But with results like this showing that the key factor for wine is the promotional price, I would say that they've dumbed down wine significantly. While I don't begrudge them their dropper backers, the loss of high-quality wine shops with service and staff who know what the wine actually tastes like and can give a real opinion is a shame. The huge range of wines is going to decrease if we continue to consider supermarkets as the best place to buy wines. Thankfully, the internet is letting lots of nice online shops fill that gap. Jane, many health practitioners worry about the addictive nature of drugs, and wine isn't too bad from that point of view. However, Bolivian wine is taking it a bit far. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, cocaine has been found in wine that's been exported from Bolivia to Bulgaria. It was found during a drugs inspection by customs officers at the Black Sea port of Varna. The container's route started in Bolivia, but the bottles full of liquid cocaine were loaded in the Chilean port of Arica, unbeknown to the owners of the Kohlberg winery. Out of the 1,020 bottles of Kohlberg wine, only 68 were reported to be real wine. The Kohlberg winery is a leading Bolivian brand and produces about 2.7 million litres a year. But Bolivia is better known for producing cocaine. It's the world's third largest producer and the third biggest supplier to the United States after Colombia and Venezuela.
Shame it wasn't fizz that we could have called it Champagne Charlie. Never mind. I do hope that Kohlberg haven't been involved in this. But a London taxi driver reportedly died after drinking liquid cocaine from a rum bottle a few months ago. Not a good thing. And while smugglers may think this is a great ruse, it's not any good if it does get onto the streets. A severe reaction to liquid cocaine is to be expected, but those with allergies to some wines have something to look forward to. Isn't that right, Jane?
Yes, a study by Bordeaux University has found that adding lactic bacteria to unfermented grape juice could reduce compounds known as biogenic amines that create off aromas in wine and can cause an allergic reaction amongst some wine drinkers. The study evaluated 264 Bordeaux wines from 2005 and 2006, of which 70% were said to contain substantial amounts of biogenic amines and were often beyond 1 milligram per litre. As well as reducing the compounds, the lactic bacteria has also helped to speed up malolactic fermentation, the process commonly used by winemakers to create a more round and fuller mouthfeel. That's it from me this week, but as always, please check out our website 3050.co.uk for these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. Biogenetic amines sound terrible, but it simply means an amine produced by man or plant. And amine is simply a molecule that contains a nitrogen atom. They're very common, and the ones that you probably know about are things like dopamine, serotonin, and histamine. It's the histamine that I've always thought caused allergic reactions, both in wine and for me with hay fever. And I take antihistamines to control my hay fever in summer. Either way, I know people who complain about headaches from drinking red wines, and if it's possible to make wines without them, that'd be a good thing. However, be careful. Often people talk about red wine giving them a headache, and I don't think it's necessarily about how much histamines are in the wine, but how much wine you've drunk. Next up though, we have the spotlight, this time looking at oxidative and reductive reactions. The change from grape juice to wine is probably one of the most important influences in the production of wine. Some people say wine is an expression of place and wines make itself. But behind that simple statement is a huge range of decisions that the winery must take. One of the biggest influences is the decision on how much oxygen and when to apply. Generally, winemakers split themselves down into two styles, oxidative and reductive winemaking. Although, in truth, most winemakers use the techniques from both camps. In general, oxidative winemaking makes for more stable, savoury wines, while reductive wines tend to contain more fruit. Historically, people used to describe this as the difference between old world and new world wines, but these days, all the regions of the world are familiar with reductive winemaking and often use these techniques anyway. But firstly, what is oxidative and reductive winemaking? It links all the way back to my high school chemistry, which I was really surprised I remembered. But the thing I remember is Leo goes grr. That is, Leo, loss of electrons, is oxidation, and grr, gain of electrons, is reductions. Often, molecules gain an oxygen molecule, such as when iron oxidizes to form rust. These reactions are a force behind a range of processes, including breathing and rusting. Many chemists call them redox reactions, which stands for reduction-oxidation reaction, where oxidation describes the gain of oxygen and reduction describes the loss of oxygen. Historically, winemaking was oxidative. Juice was extracted in a press open to the air. Barrels allowed oxygen to drip through. In the end, most wines were heavily exposed to oxygen. But oxidative winemaking is not necessarily a bad thing. Wines exposed to oxygen will see some phenolics, that's aromas, tannins and colour, easily oxidised. Often the oxidised state will solidify and drop out of the wine, making the wine more stable, but with the loss of some of the parts of the wine, often fruit. Reductive winemaking maintains these flavours and elements. Next week we're going to look at the different winemaking techniques used to produce oxidative and reductive wines. But before we have our interview with Sotheby's, how are you getting on with our mystery grape? I'm going to give you some more clues. We're talking about a white French hybrid grape with thick skins, which is well suited to cold climates due to its mid-season ripening and its ability to produce good crops from secondary buds in the event of a late spring frost. In other words, if you lose your crop, you've still got a chance of getting some more. As a result, it is widely grown in Canada and the eastern United States. Higher natural acidity, making it suitable for a range of wine styles, from light and crisp wines with racy acidity to slightly off-dry wines, as well as sweet late harvest wines and ice wines, for which it is probably the most famous in Canada. Have a ponder with that while we talk with Stephen Mould, Director and Head of Sotheby's European Wine Department. We're going to be talking to Stephen about Sotheby's, how they started, and the interesting characters in the past. Hi, I'm here with Stephen Mould from Sotheby's. How are you, Stephen?
I'm very well, thanks, yes.
Excellent. You're the head of European Wine Department, is that right?
That's right, yes.
That sounds like a very impressive title.
Well, it is, yes. But I do work with a great team of people. Serena Sutcliffe, who's the Master of Wine, is the international head. I'm really responsible for looking after the team here in London, who number about eight, including four specialists and admin and so on. And I also take a lot of the auctions.
Excellent. So did you run the auction that was run just recently with the Cheval Blanc?
Yes, that's right. I took about a third of the sale. I took half of the Cheval Blanc with a colleague of mine, Claire Collini, who she'd gone down and done some of the packing up of the wine inspection and so on. So, yes, so it's really sort of exciting to do auctions. And this one in particular was incredible because the wine was coming from direct from the chateau, And when you have provenance like that, it will always attract incredible amount of interest. I think we have quite a lot of absentee bids as well. And I think we had something like eight per lot, which I think is probably a record for a London sale. So on top of that, we had something like 20 phone bidders and a packed room. So altogether, that makes for a very exciting atmosphere.
Excellent. Mm. That's what you're doing now. How did Sotheby's originally start?
Well, the company was founded in 1744 and by Samuel Baker, and the first sales were book sales, in fact. We do, in fact, still have a book department here, which is well-renowned. And from there, it sort of grew, and they did house sales, picture sales, and so on. Sotheby's took over in the 19th century. And from there, different departments were brought in. In the 1950s, for example, Peter Wilson took over, and he was a great innovator. And in 1958, there was the Goldschmidt Impressionist sale, which I think they had seven paintings in that sale, which made a sort of world record for the sale. I think it was the most expensive ever. And one of the things he did was really to market Sotheby's and bring it to people throughout the world. He got TV cameras in, and so I think from that point, really the whole sort of art world and everything really sort of took off, and it became a sort of global circus, if you like.
Okay. Mm. And when did you start dealing with wine?
With wine, we started in 1970. The wine department set up by a master of wine called Colin Fenton, and with John Lloyd and David Monu Berry. So we had our first sale in October of that year. I think the sale made something like £25,000, which wouldn't buy you a sort of case of Cheval Blanc 47 now. But in those days, everything was relative.
Yeah.
We started off in 1970, and then Patrick Grubb, Master of Wine, he took over in 1974. He was my boss when I started in 1980. When I started there, I was a sort of lowly porter, and then worked my way up to doing cataloguing, inspecting wines under his sort of tutelage, and then took my first sale in 1985. And then from then, 1991, we appointed Serena Sutcliffe, world-famous Master of Wine, and 1993 we had the sale of Turn & Taxis, which was a huge estate in Bavaria, and they had a collection of something like 75,000 bottles. So that was one of our largest sales that we ever took. I think it was over 3,000 lots, and the sale made it well over a million, which was quite a lot then.
Over how many days?
It was over 3 days. I think it started on a Friday and finished on a Sunday. That was in German, so I wasn't actually fortunate enough to take that sale. But it was actually done at the Schloss, at the castle, and the whole thing was just really sort of amazing. It was like Baron Munchausen. It was just so huge, the whole thing.
Are they a typical type of client? You know, obviously not the scale, but
yes.
Are your clients or the people who supply you wines, are they typically from all the States?
Exactly. I mean, they don't all come from there. But for example, in our sale in July, which is coming up, we've got a collection from a royal prince from Germany. So yes, we do get those sort of collections coming through. But we also might have collections from restaurants, for example, because that's sort of natural connection, if you like. So other sales we've had have come from people like the Mirabelle restaurant, for example, when that was taken over in 97. And they had a great collection of the main Romney Conti, which went really well. And another great sale we had, landmark one in 1997, was the sale of wine from Andrew Lloyd Webber, mm-hmm. which made 3.7 million. And at the time was the highest collection for a wine sale. Followed up in the US, in New York in 1999, when we had what was called the Millennium Collection, and that realized something like $14 million, which was extraordinary.
Where did that come from?
That was from a private collector in Europe, and he stored a lot of his wine at a bonded warehouse called Octavian. Mm-hmm. It's about sort of 70 feet underground, the actual cellars, and it's a natural limestone, and amazing sort of place to collect wine. That's where he collected these things. Had fantastic sort of treasures, including 19th century Cam, going through to Bordeaux from sort of 1996, 95 in large parcels. That's where you have more than one case of the same wine. So that was a fantastic experience. It took weeks to actually sort of catalog the whole lot because we had to prepare it for export to the States and so on. And then into the next millennium, we're coming up to date, if you like. Something which has stood out is the sale in Hong Kong that we had. The actual collection came from a collector, a very big collector in the US, and the wine was shipped out there in reefers, refrigerated trucks. And the sale made, doubled its estimate, made $6.4 million, and included, you know, all the sort of best wines of the world. But it was a great experience.
So it's mainly collectors, rich old people,
yes,
who have passed away,
yes,
restaurants. Is that pretty much it?
It is. I mean, in the early days as well, when I was sort of starting off, you'd get sort of, and you still do get sort of slightly eccentric or strange people, you know, come and you're not quite sure exactly who they might be to start with. But then the early 80s, for example, I remember getting a phone call from a little old lady who said, I've got a bottle of Mouton 1929. So I gave her a price for it, which might have been a couple of £100 then. And so she said, I'll bring it down. So she came into the office and I thought, oh, she's really taking well care of this because it was in a huge box. I think she had it wrapped up with a skip and rope. And so anyway, I opened it up, lots of paper. When I took the paper off, it wasn't a bottle, it was a Jeroboam. And evidently her husband had worked at the estate and this had been a gift to him. And we checked back provenance and everything, and it was true. So we put this into auction and sold for several £1,000 to an American collector who'd bought the same wine in different bottle sizes. So like the bottle and then Magnum, which is double bottle size, double Magnum, and so on. But he not have it, had it in the Jeroboam, which is roughly about 4.5 litres at that time. And I don't know whether he drank it, but that's what he said he was going to do to see, you know, what the quality was like compared to the other bottles.
Oh, okay. So he's going to have one big tasting session all the way through.
Yeah, I think one big dinner party or whatever. So, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You mentioned provenance. That's quite an important thing with auctions. Because obviously, we've spoken to places like Livex, they sell fine wines, but they have quite particular about how old they are. You know, they do more recent vintages, and they've got to have quite managed.
Yes.
You know, it's got to come to a bonded agent and all that sort of stuff. Yes. Whereas you guys seem to be less worried about it having a traceable past, or have I got it wrong there?
No, I mean, we do go to great lengths about provenance, and if we can't really establish, you know, where the wine has come from, if it's got good lineage or not, then we won't really accept that for sale. So, you know, that's on very rare bottles like, you know, Chateau Cheval Blanc 1947 or, you know, Petra 61 and so on. So we are scrupulous about, you know, where things have come from, how they've been stored as well, you know, because you might have a good provenance in terms of who owns the wine. But, you know, also we like to go to cellars to actually see that, you know, the cellar conditions are...
How relevant is that for a wine that's, say, 100 years old? Because let's face it, it'll be pretty knackered.
Yeah.
Irrespective of the cellaring.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think, you know, a really good example is in our recent sale in June, where we had a lot of Chateau Cheval Blanc, which had come directly from the chateau. So we knew the wine had been properly stored.
Yep.
But, you know, we had bottles going back to 1900. And although we weren't able to taste that because they only had a few bottles left, Serena Sutcliffe, the Master of Wine and Head of International Wine Department, she was lucky enough to be invited down by Pierre Lurton to actually go through and taste the majority of these wines that we were putting into sale. And she was absolutely amazed how well the wines showed, particularly in sort of lesser vintages. So you had things like 1938 or 1936, you know, which really aren't cracked up to be great vintages, which, you know, she found to be in really good shape. So I think that, you know, the actual storage and the fact that the wine hadn't moved anywhere, you know, is very often key. And I've found that as well myself. When Serene started off, we went to a fantastic estate. And I think another specialist had been down there, and he'd written down some names on a sort of blue memo pad, which included things like Obreon 1899. And there was also some Latour 1878. And you know, he scribbled down a few plots. So we went down, and to start with, we were a bit disappointed because there was loads of rather young and inexpensive German wine just sort of lying around. So we dug around in these bins, right at the back underneath these cobwebs and all the dirt, there were these bottles. So we pulled out a bottle of 1878. I think there were about eight or so of these things. And we were looking at the levels, and Serena was a bit concerned because, you know, some of them were sort of at the bottom shoulder or mid to low shoulder. And, you know, it could be the wine's sort of over. So her husband, David Peppercorn, who's also a master of wine, written an authoritative book on Bordeaux, said to Serena, well, there's only one way to find out, and, you know, it's to try one. So we asked the executives of the estate, and they said, yep, sure, okay. So we pulled open the bottle in the cork in the cellar, and it was absolutely amazing. And even after sort of 5 hours after we left, we took, you know, you don't want to throw something like that away, so we took it back to the office, and it was still showing really well, you know, because you very often think with really old wines that, you know, they just know. And here was something which was quite extraordinary. And the same with the 1899. So we, you know, by tasting them, we'd established that hopefully the other bottles would be in, you know, pretty good shape. I mean, you know, you get bottle variation with those sort of things. So it can be a bit of a lottery, but to actually sort of, you know, see that wine can actually last that long is extraordinary.
It's 50 plus years is quite a lot for a red. Wine. Dessert wine I can live with. You always hear people talking about old wines being amazing or interesting. Whenever I've had old wine, I've always been really disappointed with them.
No, I mean, I think it's a matter of taste as well, you know, because some people will like their wines very young and, you know, with lots of juicy fruit and so on. And other people like to, you know, have wines which have got more, if you like, interesting or different characteristics. So I think there's that. I think also with, you know, when you're actually drinking wine, which is that sort of old, or even, you know, something from the 50s or 40s or, you know, something before you were born, you are sort of tasting a bit of history as well. So that there, you know, if you know what it is you're drinking, then there's that sort of added, you know, wow, this is from, I don't know, before the Second World War or something factor. But, you know, as a drink, you know, I've been really amazed at the quality of some wines. I mean, you touched on sort of sweet wines as well. I mean, there, you know, I've had bottles from a German castle from, say, like a 1921, I think it was, it wasn't a Trockenbitter, I think it was even just an Auschlese, which had been kept, you know, amazing. And it was like, you know, one of the most fantastic wines I've ever had in my life, you know, in terms of, it was just so full and expressive. It was incredible.
Let's get back to Sotheby's. We followed that you started off in London, down in the Strand, but now you've got offices in New York and Hong Kong. How did they come about?
The New York connection. I think it was probably in the 60s that, you know, I think the American market was seen as something. I think it was after the you know, the sale of the Impressionists that this was something that, you know, a country that we definitely needed to sort of establish his offices. And because there were a lot of important collectors out there. And so we joined up with Park Burnett. So it became Sotheby's Park Burnett. They've actually dropped that bit now, but that's what it was called at the time. So there was already an established auction house out there. We joined up with them. And so they started to have really important, not wine sales, art sales out there. And in the 90s, we also saw that, you know, the American market was very important for wine. So we looked towards establishing, you know, having sales out there. And when they changed the sort of law that allowed you to actually sort of have an auction house there in 1994, I think it was when we started. If you actually went in with a retailer who had a license already, you could hold an auction. So we went in with somebody called Sherry Lehman, and so we started our first sales there in 1994. And I went over for that and helped catalog those sales, and it was fantastic. I mean, the whole room was, there must have been about sort of 300 people there or so. Brilliant. A lot of buyers from America, but also from South America as well, Brazil and so on. So,
how about Hong Kong? Because Hong Kong's quite recent.
Yes. Yeah, that's also an area which is sort of developing very rapidly. I mean, we've had a lot of Asian buyers really since the 90s, but it's really just grown. And one of the reasons why we've had sales there is because they abolished the import tax, which was very high. It must have been something like 80% in April last year. And we saw the need to actually have auctions out there to, you know, expand the market. And
it also gives you access to China.
Which it gives access to mainland China as well.
Which is going to be quite important.
I think it's going to be huge, actually. And, you know, already, you know, some of our, well, top buyers in that sale all came from Hong Kong or mainland China. And interestingly, in our last sale in London here, the Cheval Blanc one in June this month, the top two buyers were from Beijing. So, you know, it really does show that this is a real sort of expanding market.
If you're having an auction in the UK, where are your customers coming from? Are they from the UK or Asia, America? Where are they coming from?
The buyers.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really sort of split. It's something like 15% by numbers, I would say, from Hong Kong, and probably just over 60% UK buyers. And then you have Europe, US, rest of the world. But by value, the proportion bought is higher. There's 30% from Hong Kong and just over 40% in the UK, and then Europe and US, rest of the world. So that's really the sort of demographic, if you like.
So, for example, the Asian buyers, you've got less of them, but they're purchasing more.
Exactly, by value. That's it.
Yeah. And why do you think that is? Is it just that if you're going to go enter an auction in the UK, you're going to go in boots and all, or?
Well, I think the thing is, you know, if you're going to ship wine halfway around the world, you probably want to get, you know, the best of the best. So, you know, it goes with the price. Therefore, they're tending to sort of spend money on the, you know, the first growth sites, sort of Lafite, Tour, Margaux, Brion, and Mouton, Chateau Petrus from Pomerol, Cheval Blanc from Saint-Emilion, and then the, you know, the other big number, if you like, is Domaine de la Romanée Conti. So, you know, in the top wine there is Romanée Conti itself. So those are the sort of things they really sort of look towards when they're buying. Maybe sort of super seconds as well, Pichon Lalande, Léo Lescas, maybe some Parma. But that's really, you know, they're looking towards really, you know, buying the sort of blue chip wines, if you like, and shipping them. And it makes sense in a way, because, you know, if you're going to buy something less expensive, you might as well try and, you know, we can probably source it
in the local
market. Yeah.
With a bit of markup.
Yeah.
Okay. And the last question is, where are the wines from that you're selling? You've mentioned quite a lot of Bordeaux wines.
Yes.
Is it mainly Bordeaux, or is it German?
Yeah.
How about Grange, Penfolds Grange, or even American Screaming Eagle? There's lots of sort of expensive wines out there.
There are. I mean, in our market in London, I would say probably 75% is Bordeaux. And then, you know, following on from that, Burgundy, and a little bit of vintage port. We do sell Grange from time to time, but at the moment, on the UK market, it doesn't seem to sort of sell perhaps as well as it would do in, you know, maybe Australia and so on. So, you know, we're sort of fairly sort of traditional in that respect. And got Sauternes as well, that sort of thing. So, but you know, it varies. Sometimes you get a collection coming up, which is quite sort of heavy in Burgundy. So in New York recently, for example, they had a good portion of the sale was actually made up of Burgundy, including, you know, growers not quite so expensive as sort of Jaillet and that sort of thing, like Boileau. And but again, you know, the top sort of Burgundy we sell, interestingly, I say DRC, Armand Russo, Jai. I mean, in a way, it is fairly sort of limited. The interesting thing is when we do get not so well established or more niche sort of producers, that you can actually get some really good bargains at an auction. That's the interesting thing. I think it's because they're not really so tradable as Bordeaux. I mean, it's the whole thing with people knowing who the producers are in Burgundy, probably not sort of understanding them quite so well. So, you know, everybody knows Château Lafite is Château Lafite is Château Lafite. Clos Vougeot might have 60 different producers. And, you know, is it the good one or not the good one? So people aren't quite so sure when it comes to Burgundy at auction.
So what are the bargains?
Well, as I say, I mean, I think it's, well, when you look at, you know, top vintage like 2005, where you're, you know, you're literally paying thousands for first growth, and then you look at, you know, vintages like sort of 2001 or maybe a 93 or 97, I think if you look at vintages which are not so well, you know, written up, if you like, I think that's really where you can buy some real bargains, if you like. Another thing I think is really underpriced is vintage poor, because you can buy, you know, things like War 77 for something like sort of 360, £400 all in. And then you look at, you know, more recent vintage, in comparison, you might be paying more for it. So, you know, I think that's a sector which is undervalued at the moment, is port. So, and then on, as I say, Burgundies, you know, you can get some really good deals there when they come up on, both white and red Burgundies on Etienne Sauzet, things like that. I mean, a really sort of good value at auction.
100 years ago, German Rieslings were more popular than Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Yes.
Do you sell much of that these days?
We don't, sadly. I mean, you know, German wines are fantastic, but they, you know, unless they're, you know, and we don't get a lot of them coming through, but, you know, if you've got some really fantastic 71 Trockenbeer and Auschlaser or something like that, it just doesn't seem to come up in the same way. I think what happened in the late 80s, there was the diethylene glycol scandal, you know, Pyroth and so on. And really the sort of whole market seemed to fall away then after that. And so, and also I think, you know, the move from sweeter wines to drier wines, I think they just really sort of lost popularity. So we don't really sell that, you know, much, unless it's part of a big collection or something where, you know, have some interesting bottles.
All right, then, Stephen, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Right, that ends this week's look at Sotheby's. Next week, we're going to stay with Stephen, and we're talking about the process of auctioning a wine. Before we finish up, though, we have our mystery grape. It was, of course, Vidal. Let's have the clues again. The white grape Vidal is a French hybrid, more properly called Vidal Blanc, which produces wines with fruity, floral characteristics. Its parents are Uni Blanc, Trebbiano, and the other parent is a hybrid Civil Blanc. The thick-skinned grape is well-suited to cold climates due to its mid-seasoning ripening, and it produces good crops from secondary buds in the event of a late spring frost. As a result, it's widely grown in Canada and the eastern United States. Vidal has high natural acidity, making it suitable for a range of wine styles from light and crisp with racy acidity to slightly off-dry wine, as well as late harvest and ice wines, which, of course, Canada is the most famous. Right, we're almost finished the show now. Just one last thing, our quote. This time it's attributed to Johann Heinrich Voss. Who does not love wine, women and song? Remains a fool his whole life long. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.